really, of course, this is a big subject and to cover in one Sunday school. And so I'm thankful that Joe told me he's got a bunch of copies of this book, Denominations or Associations, Essays on Reformed Baptist Associations, edited by James M. Renahan. I don't know how many of you know that, but he is my fellow pastor down there in Vista. But this is really an excellent introduction to especially the Reformed Baptist perspective on associationalism. And the title, you can see, Denominations or Associations, they're making a distinction there. Our association, the Southern California Association, is an association, it's not a denomination. And this does a good job of parsing out that distinction and also giving, really what I'll be giving you is more of just a summary of some of what's in this book. So it's nice that you have this available because that takes some of the pressure off of me to get through everything this morning. But what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit, as you can see, the doctrine and the practice of associationalism. It's just to talk about the doctrine of associationalism. What do we mean by it? Where do we see scriptural evidence for any type of associationalism between churches in the New Testament? And then to talk a little bit about the practice of association and give you a little bit of an introduction to the Southern California Association. Now, I'm not speaking as an official representative of the Southern California Association of Reformed Baptist Churches. We don't really have an official representative. So all of us as pastors who are part of the association kind of represent the association. But I'll talk about the process of even just, you know, applying for membership, what the association does. And then I'd like to end just with, to rip off President Kennedy, you know, asking two questions, kind of what can our association do for you? And then what can you do for our association? But let's begin. I'll give formal greetings before the sermon this morning from our church. But I know our people are praying for you as well, or they will. We don't meet till 9:30. We're lazy down in San Diego, I guess. So first, the doctrine of associationalism. And now I'm going to be probably doing a little more lecture than you're used to in your Sunday school hours. We tend to have more interaction as well. But if at any point you have questions or you'd like to follow up, I might ask you a couple of questions at various times. Definitely feel free. Don't feel like you'll be interrupting me or doing anything that will annoy me. The doctrine of associationalism, just to start out, kind of talking about what I call the golden mean of interchurch relations, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about different churches relating to one another, different local autonomous churches. And the golden mean, I don't know if you're familiar with that term, it kind of comes from Aristotle, but it's basically the perfect balance between kind of two extremes or two truths that might be or seem to be in opposition to each other. Aristotle had some interesting ideas about this, and for him, most virtue was a golden mean, you know, between two extremes. Like bravery was the golden mean between cowardice on the one hand and foolhardiness on the other hand. You know, foolhardiness might be considered bravery to some, but it's an extreme. And so bravery was that perfect balance. And when we talk about interchurch relations, really two truths that have to be kept in balance. One is the independence of the local church. We do believe in that. And I know that your church believes in that. And we'll talk about that and talk about the biblical basis for that doctrine as well. And then also be looking at what the Second London Confession teaches about this. So one, the independence of the local church on the one hand, but then the communion of the universal church on the other hand. We want to give expression to both of these so that we're not completely isolated on the one hand from other churches, but then we aren't placed in a relationship with other churches where we lose our independence. So those are the two kind of extremes, and what I think the Second London Confession does a really good job of hitting the right balance between those, and I hope that our association does as well. So first, the independence of the local church. In the confession, this is what it teaches. It says, to each of these churches, and in the context, this is chapter 26, they're talking about the local church as we understand it. To each of these local churches thus gathered according to his mind, Christ's mind declared in his word, he hath given all that power and authority which is in any way needful for their carrying on that order in worship and discipline, which he hath instituted for them to observe, with commands and rules for the due and right exerting and execution of that power. Now again, within the confession, everything's very, 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 very tightly bound together, and there's a lot here to unpack. But really, this is just an assertion that each individual local church has everything that it needs in order to carry out what Christ has commanded it to do. That there doesn't need to be some authority or power outside or above the local church to enable them to do what Christ has called them to do. And the proof text that you see for this, Matthew 18, 1 Corinthians 5, 2 Corinthians 2, we won't take the time to read all of those, but does anyone know what those three passages all have in common? What are they talking about? Matthew 18, yeah.
Church discipline.
And so it's interesting in some ways why they go just to aspects of church discipline, but in each of those contexts, it's very clear that it's the individual local church that is carrying out, you know, discipline, even to the point of excommunication. And the reason why our Baptist forefathers pointed us to those texts is that it's an argument really from the greater to the lesser. Really, the highest exercise of church power and authority, kind of the most extreme thing that a local church does, is carry out church discipline. And so they're saying, if the local church is sufficient to carry out its own discipline, then it's sufficient for everything else too. It doesn't need anything outside of itself. So that's the doctrine, and really you see it in many other places in the scriptures as well. But if discipline is handled in the local church, then everything else can be handled in the local church as well. And there's no other power that can come in and say, look, you need to accept this person into membership, or you need to get this person out of membership. The local church is sufficient to do that by the Spirit and the presence of Christ. And that especially in the 1 Corinthians 5 passage, you know, when you're assembled together and in the name of Christ, then, you know, you do this. You carry out this church discipline. So I'm sure your pastors have versed you well in the autonomy, the independence of the local church, that there ought not to be any power over it. And so, historically, Baptists have insisted that each local church is independent and autonomous, it's self-governing, that no individual, that's kind of episcopacy, that's having a bishop, you know, over you, or body, that's Presbyterianism, that no individual or body outside of the local church or above the local church ought to have any real power over it. And so in whatever we say about associations, we have to be careful that they don't have, you know, real church power that's going to violate the autonomy, the self-governing of the local church. So that's just kind of what I'm setting up here, that we need to keep these two truths in balance. And that we already talked about these passages on church discipline, arguing from the greater to the lesser. But on the other hand, there is the teaching in the scriptures and in our confession of the communion that exists in the universal church. We have the local church, the universal church. It's just a recognition that the word church in the New Testament, in the scriptures, is used in a couple of different senses. Sometimes it refers to one particular local church, most of the time. But then also there are times in which he talks about the church. You know, Paul will talk about the church and meaning all true believers, really not only regardless of their geographic location, but also their place in history. The universal church includes, you know, Augustine of Hippo, as well as, you know, you here today. So the communion of local church, and the confession teaches this in many places, but starts off the chapter on the church talking about the Catholic. And so whenever we use the word Catholic, like, we in our church regularly recite the Apostles' Creed together, or the Nicene Creed, in which we confess, you know, belief in the Catholic Church. And I need to just, in the text of that, you know, put it in our bulletin and put an asterisk by it and just have in the bottom, okay, Catholic with a small c just means universal. It does not mean Roman Catholic. In fact, because the word Catholic means universal, Roman Catholic is kind of an oxymoron. It's universal, but we're talking about this local, you know, Roman Catholic. It really doesn't make sense. But we're just talking about, and our confession teaches it too, the Catholic, small c, or universal church, which, with respect to the internal work of the Spirit and truth of grace, may be called invisible, consists of the whole number of the elect that have been, are, or shall be gathered into one under Christ, the head thereof, and is the spouse, the body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all. And this is taught in places like Hebrews 12, Colossians 1, and especially in Ephesians. In Ephesians 5, where Christ talks, or Paul is talking about the church and its relationship to Christ like a husband in relationship to his wife, and he loved the church and gave himself for her. He's not just talking about the Ephesian church there. He's talking about all true believers throughout the centuries. And so, you know, while insisting on the independence of the local church, the autonomy of the local church, we also want to give expression to the fact that other local churches are truly, you know, churches and also part of the church, of the universal church, the body of Christ. We don't want to cut ourselves entirely off from all other churches and just be our own little thing. But how do we do that? And that's what the doctrine of associationalism is all about. So while each, I keep repeating myself, I forget what I have coming up. While each local church is autonomous, there is still a common bond between local churches that needs to be recognized and given expression to. Many passages of scripture like we just saw there, but I think especially in 1 Corinthians 12, 12 to 26. Turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 12. Now, if you're kind of tracking with all of this, you might be thinking 1 Corinthians 12, you know that's Paul's extended discussion of the church as a body and made up of all these different members, their body parts, you know, of this one body, and they need each other, they must love each other, you know, the eye can't say to the foot, I have no need of you. It's a great passage to describe the unity of the church. And normally, automatically interpret 1 Corinthians 12 in context of the local church. And it's very true. And I think that's what Paul really is doing here. He's applying these truths to the church in Corinth and saying, because they had a problem with disunity, right? They had a problem with all these varying factions. And you know, Paul's saying, remember, you're members of the same body, you need each other. But look, look at verses 27 to 28, right after this extended discussion of one body with many members. He says to the church at Corinth and to the believers there, verse 27, now you are the body of Christ and individually members of it, and God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, so forth, and he lists all of these gifts. And if you see the way that Paul is using the word church here in verse 28, it's clear that he's talking about the universal church. He's not just talking about the local Corinthian church, because he talks about, you know, God appointing in the church first apostles. You know, the apostles didn't just belong to the Corinthian church. The apostles were the apostles of all the true churches, of the true church. And so in a very real sense, we can interpret 1 Corinthians 12 also and draw applications to the universal church, that we have this connection in which, you know, we need all the members of the universal church as well. Now, that's going to find particular expression, of course, within the workings of the local church. And so I think, yeah, you know, the primary application needs to be to the local church, and that's how we normally interpret it and how Paul is drawing out these applications. But I think also there's a very real sense in which the church universal can be considered the body of Christ, and all of us are members of that universal body as well, not even just of our local church. And then we also, if you look in the New Testament, and this is where you really kind of start seeing this play out, that there are examples of churches working together within the New Testament, you know, world, the first centuries of first century of the Christian church. And what do we see churches in the New Testament doing with one another? And I think we see actually several things, maybe more than you might initially think of. How are we doing on time? We're doing okay. Maybe let me open this up. What can you think of in the New Testament as examples of various churches working together? What were they doing? Okay, certainly, especially in places like 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, but other places as well. But in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, it's Paul talking to the Corinthian church and encouraging them to give for the relief of the church in Judea. So in a way across the Mediterranean from them, because they were having a famine. They needed help. And so he's encouraging them to give. And so churches, and not just one church, because Paul, and we'll look at that passage in just a moment, he was making around, and others were making around and collecting all this money from various churches throughout the Mediterranean world in order to take that back to help the churches in Judea. So certainly collecting money for the relief of other churches. Can you think of anything else? Some of these might be a little bit more tucked away in the epistles, and that's kind of what I want to draw out. Yes?
They exchanged each other's letters at the apostles.
Okay, good, yeah. You see, I'm preaching through Colossians right now, and at the end of Colossians, Paul says, all right, have this, after you read this letter, have it read in the church in Laodicea and read the letter that I sent to them. You know, we all desperately wish that we still had a copy of Paul's letter to Laodicea, but God knew we would probably canonize it when it shouldn't have been. But no, yeah, and we see that actually in various places. Paul saying, have this letter read in all the churches in this area, or read the letter that I sent to them. All of this kind of, which obviously shows they had some interaction with each other. Members from their churches would meet maybe on a regular basis. Of course, Colossae and Laodicea were quite close to each other. They're in the same Lycus Valley region of Asia Minor. And so especially the churches that were geographically close to each other, there was this encouragement of communication between them. Well, there are actually a few others. Of course, settling doctrinal controversy. I mean, this is one of the first examples that comes to mind. Acts 15, you had Paul and Barnabas coming down to represent the church in Antioch, but they come to the church in Jerusalem. And there, the whole church, if you read Acts 15 and look at all those details, it's the whole church that votes on this matter, that decides this matter. I mean, it's one of the key passages, I think, for, you know, kind of congregational polity. But you know, it's the whole church. And these representatives, though, from different churches who met together and actually discussed and you know, even debated to an extent, and then finally settled this matter, doctrinal controversy. So settling doctrinal controversy. And then, they write a letter to the other churches in that region saying, this is our finding. This is, you know, what we encourage you to teach and practice as well. In supplying pulpits, this might be a little bit of an anachronism to phrase it this way. You know, pulpit supplying is kind of what we call it now. But you see several examples in the New Testament where, a member of one church or a pastor of one church ends up, you know, preaching. He's commended to another church. He's allowed to teach and preach there for a while. There was this movement of preachers even in the New Testament world between these places. We'll read 2 Corinthians 8:18 in just a moment. Sharing apostolic letters, as was already mentioned, you see several examples of that. Supporting missions and needy churches. So not only just giving for, you know, physical needs of a church in another location, but also, you know, missions. Paul would talk about not just having received funds from, you know, the Philippians. He would say, it's, you know, I receive funds from all over the place. And so some of these churches were cooperating in supporting Paul and his work, and probably supporting other church planting missionaries around the Mediterranean world at the time. But particularly Philippians 4, 14 to 18. Writing letters of recommendation. We see several examples of this in the New Testament. You think of Apollos, when he came to Corinth, he was instructed more by Aquila and Priscilla, and then they wrote a letter commending him to the other churches after his doctrinal issues had kind of been worked through. But we see this, that not only would they would come with letters of recommendation from other churches so that the churches would, you know, receive them and recognize, oh, well, he's recognized as a preacher, someone who's trustworthy and sound in doctrine in this other church, so we can receive him as such. You know, and this was one of the ways they guarded against false teachers. If a false teacher came and didn't have any letter of recommendation. In fact, trying to think off the top of my hand. Yeah, it's Acts 28:21. When Paul arrives in Rome, the believers there are actually somewhat hesitant to receive him and to hear from him, because they hadn't gotten a letter from anyone in Judea about him. So you see this, the writing of letters of recommendation. You know, we still do this to an extent, and this is kind of an art in interchurch relations that's dying. But when you receive, and we still try to do it at our church, but when someone comes to you from another church, you know, to write to that pastor and say, look, was this a person in good standing in your church? Can you give us a letter to prove this? You know, because so many churches just bring in whoever, and sure, they've been bouncing around churches, and they've been causing problems all over the place, but when they come, you don't get a letter of recommendation, and you're asking for trouble yourself down the road. And then finally, and here's where I'd encourage you to turn to 2 Corinthians 8, because here's where we see something maybe even a little bit more in the official sense of interchurch cooperations. I phrase this in appointing men to carry out cooperative business. Now, 2 Corinthians 8, as we already mentioned, this is where Paul is talking about these funds that are being received to support the needy saints in Judea. But here, in this context, he's commending Titus. Again, this is Paul writing to another church, commending a brother, saying he's faithful. You see this all the time in the New Testament. But then he says in verse 18, he says, with him, with Titus, we are sending the brother who is famous among all the churches for his preaching of the gospel. So this is someone who obviously had moved around and gotten a reputation. Apollos, you know, he doesn't say especially who, but perhaps. With him, we're sending the brother who's famous. Verse 19, and not only that, not only is he famous for preaching the gospel, but he has been appointed by the churches to travel with us as we carry out this act of grace that is being ministered by us. It's interesting terminology here. He says this man has been appointed not just by one of your sister churches or one. He's been appointed by the churches. And the word that's translated in the ESV here as appointed, it literally means to elect by raising the hand. It's a voting term. And so, and here he says it's not just one church, but churches multiple voted together to appoint this man to help carry out this important work. So again, it had to be someone trustworthy. He wasn't going to squander the money. He wasn't going to steal it. It was someone who needed to be trustworthy. And so, you know, it's kind of intriguing here. You wonder what this looked like, but at least at some point there was an official action of multiple churches together voting to appoint a man to carry out an act of benevolence that they were doing together. So, you know, cooperative business, appointing men to carry out that cooperative business, something they were doing together. And also in verse 23, he says, for Titus, he is my partner and fellow worker for your benefit. As for our brothers, he's talking here about Titus and this other brother, they are messengers of the churches. And this word literally is the word apostle. I think it's right, the ESV just translating it. They didn't have the apostolic office, but they were messengers, because that's, you know, that's what apostle means. It's someone who's sent officially as a representative. But again, these men were representatives of not just one church, but of churches. I don't know, does that make sense? You get the sense that there's actually really official relationship between these churches, and they're carrying out actions together. I mean, appointing men for this business, sending men as their representatives as a whole, not just as individual churches, but as churches together. I think that 2 Corinthians 8 is a really fascinating passage in this respect, where you see official action, again, just voting by raising the hand of multiple churches together. All right, I warned you, this is kind of a flyby thing. I do commend this book to you. It's going to tease out a lot of these things a little bit more fully for you, but still in a very very accessible way. So the doctrine of association, going back to this, two truths, the independence of the local church, but also the communion that exists between local churches, recognizing each other as members of the universal church. And I think that's what the editors of the Confession were really attempting to strike, you know, this balance between these two. And they did so in chapter 26, paragraphs 14 and 15, and it's worth reading these. It says, as each church and all the members of it are bound to pray continually for the good and prosperity of all the churches of Christ in all places and upon all occasions to further it, everyone within the bounds of their places and callings and the exercises of their gifts and graces, so the churches, when planted by the providence of God, so as they may enjoy opportunity and advantage for it, ought to hold communion among themselves for their peace, increase of love, and mutual edification. I think it's a beautiful expression of this doctrine. But the one thing to point out, and this is something also that you would get from this book and that I'm not going to delve into, is that my fellow pastor, Jim Renahan, he has his doctoral thesis was about what he called the practical ecclesiology of the early Baptist, Reformed Baptist churches. So in the 17th century, the ones that, you know, wrote and adopted our confession. So he looked and he went to England and he delved through all these old church books and found out how they practiced their ecclesiology, how it played itself out in practical terms. And one of his chapters in his thesis, and I was looking for it quickly, but I know that this material is in this book in a condensed form. But he shows that when you're talking about the relationship between different churches, this word communion, especially in a phrase like hold communion together, that it refers to official associational relationships. Now, communion for us is kind of one of those nebulous words. You know, it has a lot of different nuances and different things. But Jim proves really definitively by looking at those old church records that phrase, when used in the relationship of churches to each other, means official associational bonds, to where they had, you know, recognized membership, where they carried out cooperative efforts and did things like that. So that's what we're talking about. You know, they use the word communion, we use the word associationalism. It's really one and the same thing as what's being talked about in the confession at that point. Then paragraph 15. In cases of difficulty or difference, either in point of doctrine or administration, whether either the churches in general are concerned, or any one church in their peace, union, and edification, or any member or members of any church are injured in or by any proceedings and censures not agreeable to truth and order. I know, it's a lot of words, but basically saying, so if there's any problem, if there's any difficulty or difference of opinion on things, whether between individual churches or within one individual church or even in, you know, individual members of one of the churches, that this is one of the things that the association, the communion can do. Saying if that's the case, it is according to the mind of Christ that many churches holding communion together do by their messengers. And again, you see the language there that's used there in 2 Corinthians 8. You know, they're apostles, they're officially appointed messengers. Meet to consider and give their advice in or about that matter in difference to be reported to all the churches concerned. Now, this is very carefully worded. It's not to hold court, right? It's to give advice. So they meet together and they give advice. This is one of the differences between, you know, an association and a denomination. A denomination typically can make rulings that are binding on local churches. But this says, you know, the extent of what they do, that now it's one of the purposes for which they exist. So in difficult cases, they can meet together, they can talk about it, they can debate the issue, they can give advice, but that's about it. So that they don't have power. And that's the next point that they go on to make. It says, howbeit, these messengers assembled are not entrusted with any church power properly so called. So again, especially what we saw is that ultimate exercise of church government and church power, discipline. You know, the messengers meeting together in association can't discipline. They can't discipline a member. They can't discipline a pastor of a church. They can't discipline a church itself. They can just give their advice, their opinion on the matter. So they don't have any true church power, or, you know, they're not entrusted with any jurisdiction over the churches themselves to exercise any censures either over any churches or persons, or to impose their determination on the churches or officers. So I hope you see this is what our confession is trying to get at. We want to have relationships between local churches, but at the same time, we very jealously want to guard the independence, the autonomy of each local church. We'll show how, in just a minute, how the Southern California Association tries to play this out. in a little bit of detail. There's so much more could be said. Is there any point? I'm going to transition here kind of from the doctrine to the practice. I know it was pretty rapid, but I hope you can see where this is coming from in the confession, ultimately, you know, from the scriptures themselves. How we want to have an association, we want to have this relationship, but we want to guard the autonomy of the local church. Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
Being a member of the association, mm-hmm. if at some point, and this is not in reference to this body at all, this is a situation we found ourselves in years ago.
Okay.
But say, for instance, you have a local body part of the association, and the pastor is found to be in very, very sinful situation, and it's destructive to the church body. Would the association offer, and like, would the association allow him to remain in his church and remain in the association, or is there anything within the association that would say, we've become aware of these things and we are going to ask you to leave the association?
That's exactly the type of situation, you know, really for which the association exists. And I'm going to show in a few moments, if I could just kind of delay a little bit, how in the Southern California Association something like that would be handled. Because you have to be careful about that. Like you, even just in the phrasing that you're using, I'm glad you're using that phrasing, you know, would the association allow the pastor continue in the church or in the association? Definitely not in the association, but they can't do anything about within the church because that would violate the power of the local church. Okay, but that's a good transition. So, according to the confession, then, what does an association exist to do? So, looking at these paragraphs in the confession, to encourage prayer, so praying for one another, and you can pray wholeheartedly, knowing these are like-minded brothers and sisters in Christ you're praying for. To further the good and prosperity of all the churches of Christ. So not just even the churches within the association, but further. So I would say that includes, you know, church planting efforts, missions efforts, maybe relief for brothers and sisters overseas that are struggling, like we see in the New Testament. To promote peace, to increase love, to facilitate mutual edification, and then to advise in cases of difficulty. Or differences. So that's just kind of summarizing what you saw in paragraphs 14 and 15 of the confession. So now the Southern California Association of Reformed Baptist Churches, or SCARBC, in case you're wondering, that's how we tend to pronounce it, SCARBC. We don't try to say SCARBC. it's a little hard. It's funny with our national association. It's, you know, it's ARBCA, which I think is fine and easy to say, but a lot of people pronounce it ARBCA. You know this. So SCARBC, if you want to be say it like the rest of us. I don't know if there's official way of pronouncing it, but just a very brief history, and by brief I mean brief, because we need to move on. Founded in 1989, so a relatively young association, although. SCARBC is actually the first modern Reformed Baptist association that ever came into existence. Even the National Association, ARBCA, which is a totally separate organization, totally separate in every way, that wasn't founded until, I think, early in the 90s. So the SCARBC was the first, in modern history, the first Reformed Baptist association. Really, probably the last one was the Philadelphia Association. It originally included three churches. I can't tell you who they were. Some of the church names, and I think some of the churches, you know, merged and moved and did things. I know that what now is Trinity Reformed Baptist Church in La Mirada was very influential. The pastor at that time, Earl Blackburn, was the one that kind of spearheaded the efforts to get the association going. But originally just included three churches. I think Ontario, Sovereign Grace in Ontario was another one, Pastor Steve Marcadon. This is our church, ERBC/CRBC. We used to be Escondido Reformed Baptist Church. Now we're Christ Reformed Baptist Church because we moved out of Escondido. We joined in September of 2001, in case you are interested. And then currently, the association consists of 9 churches. Just to give you an idea of the geographic spread, and it actually is quite a geographic spread, this is us in Vista. So we're, you know, the southernmost. We need more down here. And up here, it'd be good. And then there's three kind of in the greater Los Angeles area, one in Orange County, then two in LA County. Then there is Redlands, Redeemer Reformed Baptist Church of Redlands, Sovereign Grace in Ontario, and then there's two up in the Antelope Valley, one in Lancaster and one in Palmdale. Grace Reformed Baptist Church in Palmdale, that's where Pastor Rich Barcelos pastors. That's kind of the geographic spread, nine churches currently, and located, you know, decently within drivable distance of each other. And that's the point. We want to be relatively close together so that we can have this this communion with each other. So, SCARBC, the structure of the Southern California Association, really any business of the association, and well, any business is conducted at quarterly meetings, although the quarterly might be changing to three times a year or something. We're not really bound by our constitution to have them so many times. But in the past, it's been quarterly meetings in which the churches are represented by, you know, as many qualified delegates or messengers as they have. Those are church officers, so pastors or deacons can attend. But each church only has two votes at most, so only two delegates from each church. So it's kind of like the U.S. Senate, two votes each, so it's equal, right? So the big churches who come in with 17 elders can't, you know, move the vote however they want to. Two votes per church as long as they send two delegates to the meetings. And currently, the officers of Sovereign Grace Baptist Church in Ontario serve as trustees of the association's finances. I'll talk about what those finances are for in a second. Membership, now this is kind of the process that you guys are involved in. Requirements of full subscription to the confession and agreement with the Constitution of SCARBC. The process is that you apply through a member church. Now, in that sense, that's why I'm here, and that's why we had Joe down for us. We would, you know, if things move forward and you want to move forward, we would be, you know, your sponsoring church. Of course, if we're satisfied that you meet the requirements as well. And so we just wanted to visit each other's churches, get to know each other a little bit more so that we can make this recommendation if it comes to that. You apply 2 weeks before the next meeting. Delegates from the applying church are supposed to come to that meeting, obviously just to give evidence of their desire to join the association. And then admissions is by a two-thirds vote of the delegates at that meeting, and then it's formalized at one of our gatherings. I'm sure you're aware we have regular gatherings where our churches just get together for worship. So fairly simple membership requirements. You're in the middle of that. You might already know about those. Functions now. One is accountability. So a church in the association may be excluded from membership due to wanton abuse. This is, I'm quoting from the Constitution in these places that you'll see, you know, it's Article 5, Section B, that's the SCARBC Constitution. So due to wanton abuse of its power toward its members, neglect of attendance at association meetings. So if they just haven't been there for 5 years and they obviously want nothing to do with us, we can vote to have them removed from the association. Or any deviation from the Word of God and the confession of faith in teaching or practice. Now, on the surface, you might look at that and say, that looks like church power. They can exercise discipline over these churches. Wait just a moment. I'll explain just really what that means. That's what I have next. So in section E, it says, the delegates thus assembled, so the messengers of the churches, are not armed with coercive power to compel the churches to submit to their decisions. The association, and I like the way it's worded here, the association can take nothing away from the transgressing church but what it gave to it. Now, what does that mean? It's simply, we give you membership, and really what that means is our recognition, formal recognition as, you know, a true church that holds to the same confession that we all, you know, confess in common. And so, you know, if there were a situation where there was some grievous abuse of a church officer's authority, he's violating, you know, the liberties of his people regularly, or, you know, just exercising unilateral discipline to where you look at him the wrong way, he kicks you out of the church. You know, those are the type of things that when they come to the association can meet together, look into those things as far as that church and that officer is willing to allow us to look into it. But then really all we can do is say, look, you need to leave our association. We take away, we withdraw, you know, your membership and participation within our association. You can't you know, the association can't come into that church and talk to the members and say, look, you need to kick your pastor out. We don't have the authority to do that, nor should we have the authority to do that, because then that could turn into the same situation where some pastor does something or writes something on a blog that we don't like as an association, so we meet together and we get him ousted from his church. You know, hopefully that would never happen, and it should never happen because of the autonomy of the local church. But at the same time, what does that do? It provides accountability to a pastor, knowing that there's a body of men and other churches surrounding you that are going to hold you to what you say you believe and teach. And you know, if you're going to use your authority to batter God's sheep, then there's at least going to be the consequence of you know, the shame of being removed from the association and you know, having that formal recognition and fellowship withdrawn. But really, that's the only thing, and I think that's the only thing that an association should be able to do. They can't come and mess in the internal affairs of the churches. But then hopefully, too, knowing that if there is really a situation of pastoral abuse within a church or gravest sin that's not being dealt with within the church, then there are, you know, like-minded churches within a relatively close distance where, you know, abused members can appeal and could perhaps come, hopefully through the right processes. But this advice, now this is, again, what we saw in the confession, and I need to wrap up. In cases of difficulty, difference between, this is just quoting from the confession right here. You know, so again, if it's churches in general, one church, or even members within the local church, the association churches shall willingly submit these things at a hearing before the assembled elders. So if there's a problem, or if even there's, you know, a complaint that a member within a church has against the leadership within that church, this is kind of the process. A complaint or grievance can be brought by any member of the church or must be made through, by any member church or must be made through a member church. The church hearing the complaint will determine whether to make this known to all the member churches. So again, there's still a level of you know, if one of the members, say, of the Portico Church in Orange came to us at Christ Reformed and said, look, our pastors are abusing their authority, we need to do something about this, you know, then before bumping that up to the associational level, of course, we would reach out to the pastors of their church. We would say, okay, what's going on here? Try to mediate, try to solve the problem ourselves. But, you know, if there was enough evidence and it seemed that, you know, these claims were being substantiated, then the matter at the discretion of the churches could be brought to the association as a whole. Secondly, the appeal of the association church's members must first be made through his or her local church. And so that's it, too. If some member from another church came to us and said, look, my pastor is doing this, this, and this, we'd say, okay, you need to talk to your pastors first about this and have them contact us about this. Again, because we don't want to violate the autonomy of the local church. But if, after due process, the church refuses to make the matter known to the association, the members may appeal to the eldership of a member church, another member church, which in turn must then determine whether to make this known to the association. Doctrinal issues, difficulties, or matters between churches can be placed on the agenda of the association regular meetings by the eldership of any one of the churches. Now, why am I reading all of this to you? Well, I went through this with my church. And, you know, because one of the purposes of associationalism is that accountability, I wanted my people to know that they had recourse, you know, to find help if, God forbid, you know, I ever abuse my power as an officer of the church over them. I want that accountability. I need that accountability. And I think that the true pastors recognize the need for that accountability to protect their sheep even against themselves. You know, God forbid if that ever happened, if it turned out that you know, I'm ever a wolf in sheep's clothing, that my people have at least, you know, somewhere they can go, people that they can talk to find, you know, the help that they need. And hopefully, again, those situations are going to resolve themselves. They're going to, you know, we as pastors in the association are going to give each other, you know, the benefit of the doubt. We're going to look at it. We're not going to jump to conclusions, all of these things. But at the same time, if there's, you know, genuine abuse going on within a church, then that's what the association, one of the things the association exists, is just for that accountability. Now again, they can't come in, mess with things in the church and tell them what to do, but they can give their advice. They can say, look, we think that you should do this, you should handle this in this way. And then at least the church members and officers have that external perspective, have some ability to get help and counsel. We don't really need to look through that. You can see that in the Constitution. Other functions, other things that we do, not just this accountability and advice, but pulpit supply. We love to have our do this. You know, our pastors go to each other's churches, fill the pulpit. It's good for our people to be exposed to others. Financial help, again, if a church with an association, or even a member of a church within an association had some grave financial need, then the association can pull together to try to help with that. Communication, that's one of the main purposes for our regular meetings of our pastors, is just to, we give reports. We say, this is what's been going on in the church in the last few months. This is how we need prayer. This is what we're rejoicing in God for. You know, and it's one of the great benefits of having that, is we know what's going on in each other's lives and churches. Mutual edification and encouragement. What we strive to with our regular joint worship services, have our people get to know each other. You know, it's nice to know you're not the only ones out there that are preaching and teaching these things. And I remember for our church, especially for a long time, we were very, very small. And to be able to go to those quarterly gatherings and worship with, 400 other people, it was a wonderful experience. And if nothing else, just the singing, When you go to a small church, it's like, oh, come on, people sing, let's sing. And then you get 400 people and suddenly it's nice. The people in our church have formed wonderful relationships with members of other churches, and it's been such a wonderful encouragement to all of us. And then other cooperative efforts, conferences. Of course, we've got the Southern California Pastors Conference that we've started. But then also, I would like to see our association get more involved with, church planting efforts, with missions. Now, all of us are involved in that type of stuff in one way or the other. But, to do something, if there were a man who was raised up in one of our congregations who wanted to plant a church, in Temecula or something, that we'd be able to get behind that and, with our churches, support that with prayer, with financial aid as well. That's the functions. That's what we do. Again, I apologize. This has been so rushed. But two final slides. Again, it's not your association yet, if this is, what can the association or an association do for you? I'll just summarize these in three. Again, one is protection. We need this. I mean, unfortunately, we've all known, we've experienced, we've heard of cases where pastors will severely abuse, and if they don't have any accountability, if they don't have anyone around them, then there's no place for battered church members to go. And again, we don't expect that ever to be the case with you. I pray, God, that will never be the case with my people, but I'm a sinner, and I have these blind spots. And so even just the protection for individual members of churches. Fellowship, as I mentioned, a great aspect of this. And then counsel. Even if there's just a difficult situation within the church, and you think, maybe we should just ask some of the other churches. We do this regularly, Jim and I. We're like, oh, this is kind of a sticky membership issue to face. I don't really know where this person falls in this category. Well, let's see if anyone else has ever dealt with something like this. And, chances are someone has. And then finally, what could you do for your association if you join? One is certainly prayer, and this is one of the things our churches do all the time, is pray for one another. And giving, I didn't mention this, but the finances of the Southern California Association only come from, it's all voluntary, there's no fee, it's not like, okay, you have to pay us $3,000 annually if you join. Everything's voluntary, and even the churches themselves don't give directly. The way it's funded as of now is just the offerings that we take at our regular joint worship services in the churches. And then that money gets pooled. If there's a specific need, that need is made known. Like for instance, one of our sister churches who was without a pastor for a long time, they had to keep bringing men in to preach. And so that was draining on their finances because they wanted to pay these men something for their labors. And so we as an association for several months gave them money to be able to pay men to come and preach for them. And so giving, And then also just attendance. And again, the joint worship services are really are a great blessing. And as we're able to do that, we're kind of hoping to get one of these a little bit closer to you guys. Our church possibly hosting one in conjunction with others. They tend to be over there, you know, on the West Coast in LA County. We need to bring some, you know, spread out the love a little bit. But you know, as you're able to come, it'd be a good opportunity for you to get to know the association and how we work and other people within the association. The morning service starts at 9:45. Oh, at 10. Okay. I do want to end to give you a chance to make that transition. But are there any, you know, pressing questions or comments that you wanted to bring up? I hope that was as clear as could be. Again, hopefully that was just an introduction so you could start working your way. And if you're interested in these things, yeah, read that book, Denominations or Associations. It gives much more of this information in detail and then a fuller picture of everything we've gone over. But we're excited about the process of moving forward in this kind of membership application with you guys. And please, if you ever have any questions or comments, just let me know. Yes, sir.
We need fellowship on Sunday morning. Our pastor needs fellowship with other like-minded pastors. And so in that respect, I'm very encouraged that our pastor and our elders are going to have that fellowship as well with like-minded pastors.
Yeah, it is a great encouragement because, as you all know, and your pastors most of all, ministry is hard. And just to have that encouragement, the resources of others, you know, in official bonds of association is a great encouragement. Yes?
What would be the main couple differences with the denomination?
Yeah, you know, in some ways, you know, denomination is kind of fluid terms and stuff, but it tends to be... you know, in a denomination that there is at least some level of control of authority over the internal workings of a local church, even in the sense that something like the Southern Baptist Convention is a denomination. There's required money that you have to give, you know, to the convention. Everything is kind of cycled through, you know, the convention. And so even in that respect, and then also, you know, as there are determinations, they come kind of from the top down, and they tend to be binding on their churches. Whereas with us, it would only be, okay, here's this difficult matter. You know, all of our pastors, officers, delegates have met together. We've discussed the matter. This is our counsel. This is our advice on how you should proceed. Hopefully you'll take it seriously, take it to heart. But if you choose to go another way, you know, God be with you. If that means you have to leave the association, you know, God be with you. We just no longer have these official associational ties. Yeah. And there are, you know, with difference of opinion, you know, some churches that just don't fit in that, you know, and the reason why we require full subscription is that we just want to know, you know, and be able to trust each other as we work together. If we're going to plant a church with you, we want to know what kind of church is going to be planted. If we're going to send a missionary out, what does he believe? What does he teach? And so it's that for that level of trust and cooperation that we want to have, you know, a very full document that is our confession, one that's detailed rather than just brief, lowest common denominator. You know, so that's the case. You know, if a church applies and they just can't quite see eye to eye, it's no problem. we love them, we pray for them, we'll send them, but, you know, they just might not be able to join the association in our attempts. Yes?
Well, as much as you're at liberty to say, didn't you just have a church leave the association? And what was...
Yeah. It was a doctrinal difference, and we were going to go through this process and look into it, discuss the matter, but that church voluntarily decided to resign their membership. And we love them. We pray God's blessing upon them. We really do. It's just because of that doctrinal difference, at least that church decided it wasn't worthwhile to continue in formal associational bonds. Yes? Do you have any objections to talking about this, or?
No, I would just want to let you off the hook a little bit.
No, sure.
That's probably another hour-long conversation.
Yes. Yeah, definitely would. You can ask your pastor about that because he's aware of it and he can answer those questions.
You can speak to it.
Okay.
Like.
It really is the doctrine of God in chapter 2 of the confession. The presenting issue was something you may have been hearing about, the doctrine of impassibility, and a redefinition of that doctrine in such a way that again we didn't discuss it as an association. So there was never an official ruling or anything, but some within the association who felt that redefinition of that doctrine undermined really the entire classical doctrine of God. Not that it would or that it has, within that church, but just some concerns along that respect. But rather than enter into a debate about that, the church just, which they had every right to do, decided to resign and just avoid that process.
We've had conversations about the impassibility God.
Sure.
Argument. I didn't know if that was.
Yes, okay, well then that's it, yeah.
Outside of that, so.
No, that was the issue.
It's a rather complex doctrinal issue that I'd be happy to speak with you, Paul, about. And actually, you'll hear in my sermon in a couple of weeks, my intent is to actually offer a couple of Emmaus Essentials courses, first of all, on the doctrine of God, and then after that, on Christology. And so to continue to come to Emmaus Essentials would be a good thing. You'd learn more about the doctrine in that way. But also, we just had a wonderful pastor's conference on this very issue, on the doctrine of God, and in particular on the impassibility of God. It'll make your head swim kind of stuff, wouldn't you agree? And I'm still waiting for that audio to be posted. And
yeah.
When it is posted, I'll send you a link to it if you want to swim in those waters a little bit. Be free to do it. But, yeah, I think that's all that can be said on that for now.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, thank you for the time and the opportunity. Again, I'll be around if you've got any further questions. So.